Hello, Market Watcher. I'm David Rovell, and this is Value Side at the Close. Market gains technical strength on two-day rise. Golden bonds do not join in the festivities. That and today's market comment. What happened during the lockdown? All that just ahead. Well, these last 2 days in the market have been just enough to turn the technical outlook completely around. And although it certainly didn't look very convincing, our steady average prices have all turned higher on today's trading. First of all three major averages are now trading above their 50-day moving average, as are four of those big five companies, Apple, Amazon, Google, and Microsoft, all above their 50-day average. Only Facebook still trades below. And looking at the market overall, we see the same picture, with 53% of the stocks on the New York Stock Exchange now above their 50-day average, and advancing issues were also higher by a factor of 55 to 40%, and new highs finished with a very respectable 463. Put this all together and you have a very broad-based rebound, which puts behind them those first 2 weeks of the month when stocks just couldn't get out of their own way. Oil and cryptocurrencies both followed higher, while gold and bonds were lower. So stay tuned for today's market comment. What really happened during the economic lockdown? Well, it was just over a year ago that this nation was going through one of the most difficult periods in our history. We were told that a rampant pandemic was loose in the country and that we should self-quarantine, that non-essential businesses should close. In short, that our lives would be turned upside down. For some of us, those disruptions continue until this day. Now that we've had some distance put between those times, we're starting to see the full ramifications of that economic lockdown, and there are some startling results. In just a few minutes, the U.S. Census Bureau will report on the latest September retail sales for the country. But even before today's report, we see that there were some big winners and losers in the lockdown. Now, the hardest hit in the lockdown were the small businesses, the independent shops and stores that could not survive the closure. Many went out of business, and the highest number that I've seen was an estimated 500,000 independents who closed for good. Unfortunately, we did not keep official records of just how many small businesses did go bankrupt. But we do keep track of the aggregate income for retailers during that time, and it dropped by $16 billion in that devastating second quarter of 2020. The good news here was that what happened was that a pent-up demand was created. Consumers put off their purchases until after it was declared safe to leave their homes. Then they exploded in their shopping, with retail sales a year later, in the second quarter, jumping by an incredible $122 billion. So for the retailers who were able to weather last year's lockdown, this year has been much better. And we'll get to see just how much better with that release of September's numbers in just a few minutes. But this is only a look at regular brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop stores and businesses. What about the online retailers? How did Amazon and all the other internet retailers do during the lockdown? Answer: lockdown was simply the best of all possible times for e-retailers. Internet retail business jumped by an incredible 43%, with Amazon and the rest raking in a mind-numbing $49 billion extra. By far the best quarter ever for online shopping. Their problem now, for the online crew, is how to maintain that increase. And that looks to be problematic, as the numbers indicate that the American shoppers want to return to actual physical stores to see and touch, and maybe even try on, the goods and clothes that they want to purchase. Now, turning to today's release, retail sales have been released for September, and it showed an increase of 0.7%. Perhaps this indicates a willingness on the part of the American consumer to return to a more normal shopping environment. After all, this consumer does represent about 2/3 of our economic activity in this country, And remember, it's just 71 days until the biggest shopping event of them all, Christmas. Well, it's risk versus no risk. It's a question that portfolio managers need to ask every day, because this equation between these two kinds of returns changes all the time. In other words, it's extremely dynamic. Let's explore the concept. U.S. Treasuries are generally considered a no-risk investment. Invest in Treasuries, and you'll get your money back plus interest when they mature. Now, for today's discussion, we'll ignore the interest rate risk. You assume that if you invest in bonds, and the rates go up, and then you try to sell before the bonds mature. Now, under those circumstances, you may indeed lose money. But for today's discussion, we'll assume that you are investing in Treasuries and holding them until maturity. Hence, you have as close to a riskless investment as is humanly possible. Stocks, on the other hand, are a risky investment. There's an inherent amount of risk that you assume each time you invest in stocks. So we can look at the investment process as one in which we would choose the no-risk Treasuries when their rates are high enough to be what we consider attractive, and that attractive level may vary from investor to investor. But when no-risk Treasuries yields are not high enough, we choose stocks. And here's the point. The yield on Treasuries is currently rising, becoming more and more attractive, while the risk, and therefore presumed return on stocks, is declining. The most vivid example of what's occurring right now is the 5-year U.S. Treasury. It closed on Friday with a yield of 1.05%. Now, that might not seem like much, but when you realize that that's just about 3 times higher than it was back at the beginning of the year, you realize that this has been a dramatic move up in Treasury yields, especially in this mid-range sweet spot for Treasuries. So mid-range Treasuries up by a factor of nearly 3 times. What about stocks? Here, the risk of a decline appears to be growing, although it is way too early to state this definitively. Since the beginning of October, and remember that's only 10 trading days, so in those 10 trading days, all of the major stock market averages have begun trading below their 50-day moving average. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Standard & Poor's 500, and NASDAQ, all currently below the average price for the last 50 days. Now, market technicians consider this a downtrend, although granted, it is a very short duration. Now, you can bet that there are investment managers who have already observed this trend and begun moving assets from stocks to bonds, especially for those extremely risk-averse clients. Now, overall, this can be the setup which produces a bear market in stocks. Rising bond yields, rising stock risk, and Wall Street completely changes its allocation from an emphasis on stocks to an emphasis on bonds. This has not occurred since the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates in the wake of the great financial crisis of 2008. But they look to be getting close to raising rates now. Add to this the beginning of earnings season, which kicks off with the J.P. Morgan results on Wednesday, and you have the setting for some pretty exciting times over the next few weeks. So stay tuned as Wall Street measures risk on or risk off. Well, the Chinese market is vast. With a population of 1 billion, it is a marketplace of unimaginable depth. And that's the carrot that has enticed American politicians and businesses for nearly 50 years. Think about how American businesses could prosper, they would say, if they could just gain 1/4 of the Chinese market. They would then double their American counterpart. It's the reason that Nixon opened up China back in the 1970s. The siren song, which led businesses like Apple and Nike to relocate plants and create giant marketing plans just for the Chinese. China is the marketer's pot of gold, a place of unlimited numbers of potential customers. And indeed, China has looked like that until recently. The Chinese economy has been the fastest growing economy in the world, nearly doubling the rate of growth of the USA. China has been one of Apple's and Nike's chief markets. Selling iPhones and sneakers to the Chinese has become a central component of their profitability. And perhaps most importantly, China has been the real estate empire of the world, with giant newly built cities just waiting for the people to move in and create the metropolis of the future. It's been a wonderful model that combines the normal attributes of real estate, a place to live or retire, and an investment. Instead of investing in the stock market, the Chinese people have used real estate as their chief investment vehicle. And why not? Unlike the stock market, Chinese real estate seems to always go up in value, climbing and climbing and multiplying the Chinese investors' wealth. That is until this year. This year, that all seems to be crumbling. For developers around the country, of whom Evergrande is but the most famous, cash flow is drying up. Empty apartments don't pay rent, and forward sales are down about a third, according to Bloomberg. Now, the Chinese model of real estate investing, where buyers often take years to actually move into their apartments, seems to be cracking. And the epicenter of this crash is the bond market. If there is one thing that bonds require, it is timely interest payments. And right now, that's missing in China. On Monday, Evergrande missed yet another bond interest payment. That makes number two. And like the first, Evergrande bondholders must wait for a 30-day grace period to expire before they will find out if these bonds are in default. Now, bond number one's grace period expires next week, and we have to assume at this point that the only way that bond gets paid is for the Chinese authorities to bail out Evergrande, something I don't think is going to happen. So I believe the odds are overwhelming that Evergrande will default on bond number one. And not just the Chinese will be affected. One component of bond number one is the U.S. dollar-denominated offshore bond, which we believe has a number of U.S. investors. So as you can see, should Evergrande and the other Chinese property developers default on their bonds, it will likely have a worldwide impact. And the meme of a vast Chinese marketplace, a siren song of unlimited riches, will never be the same. Well, we call it the supply chain. And by that, most of us generally mean that we're having a difficult time getting those everyday products that we use. The store shelves begin to empty. We call it supply chain issues. Auto plants have to stop because they can't secure the computer chips needed to build their cars. It's the supply chain, don't you know? Even the Federal Reserve points to supply chain issues as the reasons for our current bout of inflation. And here's where this supply chain issue gets real. We're about to embark on an entirely new course in our monetary policy to fight an inflation that's caused by, you guessed it, the supply chain. But what if I told you that this is all wrong? That our current inflation issue has a basic structural cause, that our economy, as currently structured, is designed to be inflationary. And what's more, last night, China demonstrated it. You see, last night China reported on the prices of their true supply chain, called the Producer Price Index. Now, the PPI is the current price of the raw materials used in producing the finished products that China consumes and sells to the rest of the world. And like everyone else, China's supply chain is having real issues, reflected in their producer price index, which was up by a whopping 10.7%. That's an all-time record. China, like all the rest of the world, is indeed having a great deal of difficulty sourcing raw materials. Food, like the corn and rice America sells to China. Energy, like the coal America sells to China. Minerals and metals, like, well, you guessed it, America sells to China. Are you seeing a pattern here? It's America which sells much of the raw materials to China, and it's from America, at least in part, where China's elevated producer prices come from. Fair enough. So if China's economy operated like our own, wouldn't we see record high inflation? After all, that's how we're told it works in the USA. But no, China's inflation barely registered at a mere 0.7%, less than 1% inflation. And incidentally, inflation in China declined from the month before. How can this be? Answer, China is a major producing country. In fact, the world's largest producing country. And yes, the higher raw material cost does impact China, but only very slightly. By the time the Chinese factories turn out their finished goods, those higher raw material costs have been passed along. You see, real pricing power is at the factory, not at the farmer or the energy producer. China absorbs raw material increases and just passes those increases along. This is not at all what's happening in the USA. America is buying those finished goods from China. We don't have a supply chain at all. We buy comparatively few raw materials from offshore. What we really buy, by the container shipful, is finished goods. Those same goods that China is happily using to pass along higher raw material costs to us. So we don't have a supply chain. We're not getting supplies. We have a finished product chain. It's China that has, for a very long time, had the pricing power in this equation, undercutting American producers to gain market share for years. And now that the times are tough, passing along any raw material cost increases that they may incur. Ironically, many of those raw materials came from the USA. It's a model that is literally hundreds of years old. It's called mercantilism. It was, by the way, the model that the European empires of the 17th and 18th century used to colonize the world. And it's the way that China is colonizing us. We don't have a supply issue at all. We have a finished product chain issue. And it's because we've become a proto-Chinese colony. Well, it's often said that it's rarefied air on Wall Street. Well, if that's true, the air is even more rare uptown at the Park Avenue headquarters of the nation's largest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase. I almost said the nation's largest commercial bank, but with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, the House of Morgan became so much more than just a commercial bank. Today, the Morgan is the second largest mergers and acquisition firm in the world, a business they were barred from under the aforementioned Glass-Steagall. And it was mergers and acquisitions that were the real driving force behind J.P. Morgan's stellar earnings today. The street estimates were for Morgan to earn about $3 per share, but in fact they beat that, coming in at a $3.74 per share mark. And over a quarter of that revenue came from mergers and acquisitions, M&A. And this underscores the two-tier economy that we have. On the one hand, there's the economy of you and me, one measured in terms of products and services, the everyday commercial interchange of everyday business. But on the other hand is the economy of finance, a world in which whole companies are bought and sold, merged into mega firms, generally in technology, building the dominant enterprises that really drive this economy. We all know the names so well. Walmart, Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft. We watch them every day when we look at the stock market. And as I've pointed out before, these are by and large less technology companies and more investment bankers themselves. A quick look at Wikipedia shows literally hundreds of companies that these firms have acquired in becoming what they are today. Google acquiring YouTube and Fitbit. PayPal acquiring Honey, Verizon purchasing AOL and Yahoo, Cisco acquiring AppDynamic, and the list literally goes on and on and on. And each acquisition becomes an integral part of what makes the parent company what it is. Imagine Google without YouTube, or Verizon without AOL. And J.P. Morgan has been the perfect facilitator for all this, providing bridge loans and M&A expertise that has helped make today's acquisitions possible. That's why Morgan's M&A services surged to $3 billion this quarter and now represents over a quarter of Morgan's total revenue. Now, I would be missing all of this if I didn't point out the other partner in this equation, the unsung hero, which really makes it all possible. That's right, it's the stock market. With a red-hot bull market like we've had for literally years now, acquisitions become the principal way companies expand. It is, after all, easier to put together a deal using your newly appreciated stock than it is to actually build something. Better to buy your competitor out than outcompete him. And so we should expect to see more and more deals for as long as this bull market remains. But should the market falter, then we will see the M&A business dry up as it does during each and every bear market. Now, one final note on Morgan's earnings. For those concerned about the nation's health, you'll be happy to know that the Federal Reserve, at least, has essentially declared that the worst of the pandemic is now over. The Fed allowed J.P. Morgan to release $2.1 billion from its reserves, reserves that the Fed determined would be needed for the pandemic, but not now. That release contributed about 20% of Morgan's bottom line. And that's the value side for Wednesday, October 13. I'm David Revelle. Please join me in praying that our country may get back to work.